Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This episode contains audio and descriptions depicting violence, as well as some harsh language. Please take care when listening. It's August 21st, 1992. Almost a year before the government standoff at Waco, Texas. A group of deputy U.S. marshals are trudging along a forest road on a reconnaissance mission in a remote part of northern Idaho known as Ruby Ridge. What you're hearing is footage shot by them on a video camera.
Well, this is the approach from the east. How far you figure?
The marshals are here to surveil a man named Randy Weaver, a white separatist involved with the Aryan Nations. 2 years before, Weaver jumped bail on a gun charge, and ever since, he's been holed up with his family in a mountaintop cabin here in these woods. The marshals proceed quietly and with caution. Weaver and his family are known to be heavily armed.
At the first fork in the road, we took a left up a steep hill.
They pass a fork in the road that leads up to Weaver's cabin when they hear a sound in the distance. It's the Weaver family dog, a yellow lab named Striker, and the barks are getting closer. The marshals beat a retreat back to the fork and take cover as Striker comes bounding toward them. Randy Weaver's 14-year-old son, Sammy, isn't far behind the dog, carrying a rifle. As Striker bears down on the deputies, one of them opens fire, killing the dog. Sammy Weaver raises his rifle, taking aim at Marshal William Deegan, and pulls the trigger. At that time in the American Northwest, the federal government was in the process of trying to root out a growing problem. An increasingly organized and violent white supremacist movement. Where once these groups existed on the fringes, without much of a network between them, individual cells were starting to organize around a group called the Aryan Nations.
Aryan Nations leader Richard Butler told me, within the next 5 years, there will be a great war that will decide whether the white race continues.
We've offered ourselves up to try to save America.
To achieve their ultimate goal of a white world, these groups were executing brazen robberies, carrying out targeted murders, and stockpiling weapons. They were soliciting funding from all around the world and recruiting and training foot soldiers in militaristic camps across the United States. And they were doing all of it with one goal in mind.
Overthrow the present government and establish a white homeland through any means we can.
The anti-government ideology of these fringe white power groups would eventually become widespread. It would lead to devastating acts of domestic terror, violent standoffs with the federal government, and ultimately, decades later, the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right. Episode 2. The revolution begins. For as long as white people have lived in America, white supremacy has existed here. It's the animating force behind ideas like Manifest Destiny that left millions of Native people dead as white people moved to settle North America. It drove the South to try to secede from the Union over slavery, sparking the Civil War. And after that, generations of Jim Crow laws and the Ku Klux Klan terrorized minorities across the country for decades.
Let us not be gullible enough to expect ourselves to get into the gutter with the Negroes themselves by meeting them head on in the streets with baseball bats or bricks.
By the 1960s, the Klan was working towards its ultimate goal: return America to its founding as a white Christian nation through any means necessary.
5 murders, 13 alleged members of the Ku Klux Klan said to be involved in the killings.
And their atrocities and their violence can be visited on anybody that disagrees with them in any given situation.
There were Klansmen at every level of government. And particularly in the South, the Klan often enjoyed the support of police and state and local government while terrorizing the black community. But starting in the 1950s, with the advent of the civil rights movement, it was clear that America was starting to go another way.
Dr. King, how are things shaping up now for tomorrow?
We hope to see the greatest witness for freedom ever taken place.
The Klan responded to the civil rights movement with violence.
They died in Birmingham. Dynamite exploded on a Sunday morning, killed 4 little girls in Sunday school, injured 20 others.
The 1963 bombing of a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, killed 4 girls and shocked the nation. Federal and local investigators formally named 4 Klan members as the perpetrators, but no charges were filed until almost a decade later. Meanwhile, the Klan's reign of terror continued, sometimes with the help of local government officials.
Tonight, Andrew Goodman and 2 companions, Mickey Schwerin and James Cheney, are the focus of a whole country's concern. They have been missing since Sunday.
In Mississippi in 1964, the Klan conspired with a local sheriff and a sheriff's deputy to murder 3 civil rights workers. The federal government had had enough. Less than 2 weeks later, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act into law.
I urge every American to join in this effort to bring justice and hope to all our people. Let us close the springs of racial poison and make our nation whole.
The Civil Rights Act was seen by white power groups as a great betrayal by the federal government. With the government now working against them, any hope of a return to a white nation died. Starting in the 1970s, the goal of white supremacist organizations started to shift. Where once they saw themselves as vigilantes, terrorizing minorities in support of the white-run government, they started to see themselves as revolutionaries. To accomplish their goals, they had to overthrow the government first. But how could that ever happen? How would a bunch of ragtag white power groups ever stand a chance against the might of the federal government and its literal armies? There was no guidebook for that sort of thing. That changed in 1978.
The book is called The Turner Diaries. It is a work of fiction, but it foreshadows an ugly fact.
In 1978, a white supremacist named William Pierce published a novel called The Turner Diaries, a roadmap for how the movement could overthrow the government.
Both the government and the media are doing very destructive things to our people. We have to change that. We have to regain control.
This is Pierce in a rare interview with CNN.
When you say we have to take control back, control from whom?
Members of the Jewish minority in this country.
Pierce had worked for the American Nazi Party in the 60s. But for Pierce, the American Nazi movement wasn't extreme enough. He believed in a conspiracy theory well-traveled in white power circles, that Jews controlled everything, including the government. And he believed the only way to take back the country for whites was to overthrow the federal government. In the 1970s, Pierce founded a militant neo-Nazi group called the National Alliance. But it was his novel, The Turner Diaries, that would be his most lasting contribution to the white power movement.
The Turner Diaries has sometimes been called a plan or a blueprint for some of the violence that we've seen, and that's simply nonsense.
The novel takes place far in the dystopian future, where whites have lost power and control. It's written as a series of journal entries by a revolutionary named Earl Turner. The diary traces a second civil war that begins when the U.S. government, controlled by the Jews, seizes everyone's guns. The book's protagonist, Turner, joins an underground resistance group in guerrilla warfare against the government. He carries out assassinations, stages acts of economic sabotage, and participates in mortar attacks on the Capitol building.
We saw beautiful blossoms of flame and steel sprouting everywhere, wreaking their bloody toll in the ranks of tyranny and treason.
Later, Turner blows up the FBI headquarters in D.C. using a bomb made from fertilizer. Because of these exploits, Turner's asked to join an elite group of masterminds known as the Order.
As members of the Order, we are to be the bearers of the faith.
We'll discuss the Turner Diaries more in later episodes, but suffice to say that the book ends with the overthrow of the government, a day called the Day of the Rope, a mass hanging of what the Order calls race traitors, people like politicians and journalists. Then there's a global nuclear war and the systemic extermination of all non-whites on the planet. You know, just your normal, regular old doomsday fantasy. But for William Pierce, it wasn't just fantasy.
With such writings, Pierce hopes to rouse what he believes is an angry white constituency.
Probably the most important idea expressed in the Turner Diaries is that each of us has to stop being a spectator and start being a participant.
Were you to go and read it, you would very quickly discover it is a very bad novel. It's a very bad novel.
This is Kathleen Ballou, a historian and professor at Northwestern University who has studied the origins of the modern-day far right and the importance of the Turner Diaries.
As you're reading the novel, you can't help but wonder why in the world was this so important to this movement? And the reason is that it answers a fundamental question for this movement, which is, how can a tiny fringe movement hope to overthrow the most militarized superstate in world history, the United States? This is the jump that people had to make to really commit to a white power movement that was oriented against the state. There had to be this leap of faith that there was a path forward. It is not just a novel. The Turner Diaries lays out a plan of action.
The Turner Diaries spread like wildfire through the white power movement, finding an audience with a diverse far-right fringe that by the early 80s was already sick of the government. The middle class that had flourished after World War II was waning with the rise of globalization. Trade deals made by the government were killing American manufacturing and erasing good working class jobs.
5,000 steel workers lost their jobs.
It's hard to believe that we're put out on the street and don't know what we're going to do.
And while middle America struggled, stock market deregulation fed the greed is good era of Wall Street. While the rich dined, crime in major cities was on the rise. The threat of nuclear war seemed to loom larger than ever. So maybe it's not that surprising that around this time, conspiracy theories about shadowy groups of elites who control everything, to the detriment of society, were rising. You may have heard of some of them. The New World Order, the Illuminati. The Turner Diaries fit right in there, with a white power bent. It reflected a growing fear felt by many on the far right, that on its current course, the world was coming to an end. But it also provided a violent course of action. White separatist groups started popping up across the country, armed to the teeth, and making righteous claims about saving America from itself.
When you go into these big cities, and there are streets that you can't walk down without being thumped, you know it's getting bad. When homosexuality is in open view, you know it's getting bad. When witchcraft and communism is everywhere, you know it's getting bad.
It's a deeply embodied fear that the apocalypse is coming through intermarriage, through immigration, through abortion, through changes in society, that all of these things that create fewer and fewer white babies would end in the annihilation of the white race itself.
A new movement was starting to create an all-white homeland within the United States. And at the center was the leader of a neo-Nazi church in Idaho known as the Aryan Nations, Richard Butler.
Your race is your nation. Forever it has been so. Your race is your nation.
Butler, a former engineer, had been attracting hate groups and individuals to Idaho for decades. He often spoke of a coming race war and of building a new nation of white people in the Northwest.
We're going to establish a white Christian environment. It is a sanctuary wherein our kind can live their culture, reproduce their own kind, and build their civilization.
The ultimate goal was to take over the northwest corner of the U.S., Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and Montana, a region that was already predominantly white. It was a task, Butler often acknowledged, that would not succeed without first dealing with the federal government. A task that would not succeed without bloodshed.
The White Power movement was different from prior Klan groups because it was not a vigilante organization. It did not seek to uphold existing power structures. What it wanted to do was revolutionary. It wanted to overthrow the United States government.
Looking forward to it?
Sure.
What are you looking forward to?
See what they have to say.
Every year since 1981, on its remote compound in Hayden Lake, Idaho, the Aryan Nations hosted its annual World Congress. It was an event that attracted hate groups and thousands of interested people from all over the country.
What are you looking to hear?
I don't know. I'll listen to what they have to say and decide for myself what I want to think about.
The event featured sermons, speakers, and the occasional cross burning. But the Aryan Nations World Congress of 1983 was a little different. It would change the trajectory of the white power movement in the United States forever.
At this summit of leaders from the movement all across the country, there was a backdoor meeting where leaders decided to overthrow the federal government. They decided to take up arms and wage war against the state.
At a closed-door meeting, Aryan Nations members met with members of a group called the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, or CSA. Inspired in part by the Turner Diaries, the CSA had already been training its members in military tactics at a compound in Arkansas. Also at the secret meeting was a man named Robert J. Matthews. Matthews had been a member of the National Alliance, the neo-Nazi group founded by the author of the Turner Diaries, William Pierce. This is Matthews.
Hey, why don't you Jews get the heck out of here? I didn't come all the way down here to hear you.
Matthews was planning to start an offshoot group of his own. Inspired by the Turner Diaries, he called it The Order. The Order would behave much like the Order in the Turner Diaries, waging a low-level war against the government. But first, they needed to fund their revolution. They needed money. Initially, they planned to rob pimps and drug dealers. But after a few weeks tailing black men in flashy cars, they realized that they had no idea what a pimp or a drug dealer actually looked like. Instead, they robbed an adult video store in Spokane, Washington, stealing just over $350. Afterward, Matthews called up a friend from the National Alliance. He said, "The revolution has begun." Matthews and the Order started robbing banks, taking $26,000, then $43,000. On the side, they made counterfeit money and pulled off burglaries. They dumped all the cash into a fund for other white power groups to use to prepare for the coming revolution. Some members of the Order spent time in Arkansas, training at the compound of the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, CSA.
Go! Quick.
They trained for a coming race war, just like the one in the Turner Diaries, firing at crudely drawn targets of black people, Jews, and police officers wearing Stars of David instead of badges. Remember, these guys thought Jews controlled the government they were planning to overthrow.
They have to stand and fight, and that's what we teach them to do.
But you teach them to kill as well?
If necessary.
The Order, the CSA, and other white power groups were some of the earliest adopters of the organizing power of the internet. They communicated on a pre-webpage message board known as the Aryan Nations Liberty Net, that became a crucial rallying point for the radical right. On it, they shared information and resources, and even what they called a computer index of traitors, a list of FBI agents, judges, and people they wanted to eliminate. One of those targets was a Jewish radio talk show host named Alan Berg.
You're listening to Alan Berg on KOA.
Alan Berg on KOA.
Berg had long clashed on air with white supremacist leaders.
I think you're sick. I think you're pathetic. I think your ability to reason and use any logic is
tragic. Why don't you put a Nazi on your program and then you have somebody can...
Sir, you are a Nazi by your very own admission. Thanks so much.
On June 19, 1984, Berg was found dead in his suburban driveway.
Alan Berg was killed in ambush, arriving at his Denver home. 10.45 caliber shell casings were near his body.
He had been murdered by members of the order. A month later, members of the order were riding in two pickup trucks on Highway 20 in California, following an armored Brinks truck. One pickup pulled out in front of the armored truck, and order members, their faces covered by bandanas, fired shotgun rounds into the bulletproof windshield. They dumped nails in the road to try to flatten the tires. One held up a sign that told the drivers, "Give up or die." Eventually, the truck pulled over, and the driver opened the vault. Inside was $3.6 million.
The fact is, the suspects in two pickup trucks shot out the windows and the tires of the armored...
The robbery made national news. It was the largest open road robbery in American history, and it got the full attention of the U.S. government. A pistol dropped at the scene traced back to one of the members of the order. The FBI quickly identified seven of the 12 robbers, and the net began to close.
Another one of the fugitives was arrested yesterday in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
As the feds began raiding some of the order's hideouts, arresting members, they were troubled to find officers' own home addresses and names on the gang's hit list. And the order's leader, Robert J. Matthews, was still at large. In the early morning of November 24th, 1984, FBI agents surrounded a motel in Portland, Oregon. They'd learned from an informant that Matthews was holed up in there and were waiting for him to emerge. Matthews left his motel room and caught a glimpse of the FBI agents. He ran down the stairs toward the parking lot. As he fled, gunfire ensued. Matthews fired at an agent, hitting him in the leg. A bullet hit Matthews in the right hand, but he managed to still escape on foot. He wrapped his hand and hitchhiked to a local hideout, eventually leaving Oregon altogether for a group of safe houses on Whidbey Island, off the coast of Washington State. There, he wrote a manifesto which he called a declaration of war against the Zionist occupation government of North America, a reference to the Turner Diaries' notion that Jews controlled the government. He finished the manifesto, "Let the battle begin."
On Whidbey Island, offshore from Seattle, Washington, there is one man tonight who's not likely to get away from the dozens of FBI agents surrounding him.
On December 7th, agents cornered Matthews at his Whidbey Island safe house.
Dozens of FBI agents, armed with automatic weapons and dressed in full combat fatigues, have been bused to the scene. Matthews is thought to be heavily armed.
A gunfight between Matthews and the feds broke out and raged for over 36 hours. It was clear that Matthews had no interest in being taken alive. And then, in a preview of what would happen at Waco years later, agents fired tear gas into the house. Finally, in an attempt to smoke him out, they dropped flares on the building.
The house is on fire. Tear gas, as we know, is extremely flammable, and we do not know at this moment whether Matthews is still inside the house. We will have an update of that.
But even when the building caught fire, Matthews never came out.
A vacation home where Robert Matthews was holed up for 2 days is a burned-out hulk tonight. An FBI manhunt is over and a fugitive apparently dead.
The FBI had rounded up most of the order, but a few members were still at large, hiding in safe houses around the country. Meanwhile, in Arkansas, the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord was planning to make its initial assault on the government. Much like the Order in the Turner Diaries, they planned to use a rocket launcher to attack a major federal building. The target? The Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. But the CSA never got the chance.
About 70 members of the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord were holed up in their compound when federal agents arrived with a warrant for the arrest of their leader, Jim Ellison.
On April 19, 1984, about 300 federal agents moved in to surround the CSA compound.
Cult members refused to let agents in, and federal officers kept their distance because they knew this organization had been stockpiling weapons.
But although the CSA's leader, Jim Ellison, had warned that he wouldn't be taken alive, the FBI brokered his peaceful surrender.
We've arrested Mr. Ellison on a warrant that was outstanding, and we've arrested two other members of the group known as the Order. And we've seized many, many items that were listed in the search warrant for the compound.
Hundreds of weapons were seized, including assault rifles, grenade launchers, and landmines, as well as 30 gallons of potassium cyanide that the CSA was going to use to poison the water supply of a large American city in order to spark the race war they hoped to launch.
Today's arrests are in keeping with what FBI Director William Webster says is a main priority, cracking down on domestic terrorism.
By December of 1985, 21 members of the Order either pleaded guilty or were convicted on racketeering charges. The FBI claimed victory, saying it had broken the back of neo-Nazi activity in the American Northwest. But that wasn't exactly true. The radical movement started by the Order and the CSA had already taken hold nationally. To them, Robert J. Matthews was considered a martyr. You could see the impact at the 1986 Aryan Nations World Congress.
Cameras were banned altogether for most of the weekend, and when they went away, the gloves came off for a weekend of hardcore hate.
It was clear what people there thought of the Order.
The Order are heroes. What they did has set an example. They took a stand against the federal government and what we deem the traitors in our system that must be eliminated.
And you're prepared to do that yourself?
No comment.
In the days and weeks after the World Congress, Aryan Nations members carried out bombings and continued counterfeiting operations. In the eyes of the White Power movement, the fight was just beginning. But the federal government was gearing up for a fight, too. It was building a case it hoped could bring down the entire White Power movement.
The government has moved in force against the radical right, and in an extraordinary nationwide sweep, agents moved in today and picked them up.
In April 1987, an Arkansas grand jury indicted 14 White Power leaders across the Klan, the Order, the CSA, and the Aryan Nations.
10 of the 15 people indicted today are accused of plotting to overthrow the U.S. government through a variety of crimes.
Robberies, counterfeiting, assassinations of federal officials, assassination of ethnic groups, bombings.
The Justice Department says today's arrest wipe out the white supremacist group known as the Aryan Nations.
This is called Operation Clean Sweep.
Kathleen Ballou again.
It's all designed to put forward this huge federal trial in Fort Smith, Arkansas in 1987-88.
Prosecutors plan to argue that these groups had been engaged in a seditious conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government. Yes, that's the same crime that some participants of the January 6th insurrection have been convicted of today.
Seditious conspiracy. The charge that members of this group had conspired together to violently overthrow the United States government.
The Fort Smith sedition trial would be the biggest, most ambitious, most high-profile attack on far-right extremism in modern American history.
The trial will be long and cumbersome, attorneys expecting it to take 3 months to reach a verdict. But in the end, prosecutors hope that in convicting the godfathers of organized racial hatred, they'll have finally broken the back of the white supremacist movement.
Every day of the trial, the defendants were led into the courthouse in chains. Sometimes the White Power leaders yelled threats at reporters.
White forever!
Remember, a pivotal moment in the Turner Diaries involves the hanging of journalists.
Your day's coming, Lee. Remember that. Our arms long enough.
they were absolutely planning a Turner Diaries attack on the United States. That's what they said they were doing. They wrote about it at length. But this trial was a disaster.
At one point, federal judge Morris Buzz Arnold told prosecutors they had better add more substance to their case or he would have to consider a mistrial.
There were chain of custody problems that excluded critical evidence. Two of the jurors had romantic relationships with defendants during the trial, which I think anybody could agree is an impartial jury problem.
The government recovered, but to what extent may only be known with the final verdict.
This huge gambit by the DOJ resulted in an acquittal of everybody.
In Fort Smith, Arkansas, after a seven-week trial, 13 white supremacists charged with plotting to overthrow the government have been found not guilty.
The defendants were acquitted by an all-white jury.
The defendants left the courtroom triumphant and defiant.
One, I want to praise Yahweh's holy and precious name. Two, I want to say to hell with the federal government.
It was incredibly embarrassing.
We thought we had met the elements. And we thought we'd proved it beyond a reasonable doubt, but apparently we hadn't.
They had been looking for a decisive victory. What they got was a front page story in one paper under the headline, "Jubilant Racists Win Trial." They even returned the weapons to the activists at the end of the trial, which is just stunning.
Civil rights groups say they are concerned that the verdict will now lead to a resurgence by white supremacist groups.
In the wake of the Fort Smith trial, national resources for investigating white power groups shrunk. But in the Pacific Northwest, violence by the Aryan Nations continued, and federal investigators kept probing, always looking for a way in. A domino they could knock over that would finally bring down the organization and derail the movement. By 1989, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the ATF, had infiltrated the Aryan Nation's headquarters in Hayden Lake, Idaho. They had an informant on the inside who they were going to use to flip other Aryan Nation's members. In October of 1989, that informant approached a man after a talk at the compound. This man, Randy Weaver.
He claimed to be a gun runner, making big bucks, had good business going. He acted as though he was my friend and tried to talk me into doing illegal acts.
This is Weaver testifying about what happened with the informant years later in front of the United States Senate. The informant told Weaver he would pay him to modify two shotguns by cutting the barrels by a quarter inch. Modifying shotgun barrels is a violation of federal law. But to the often unemployed Randy Weaver, it was just an easy way to make a quick buck.
He caught me in a weak moment when I needed some money, and biggest mistake of my life, went ahead and did it.
About 6 months later, two ATF agents showed up at Randy Weaver's cabin in northern Idaho, in an area known as Ruby Ridge.
Basically what they said was that we're going to take you to court on six or seven firearms violations if you don't join our team.
The ATF wanted Weaver to become an informant inside the Aryan Nations. You can go to hell, he told them. He saw the setup as a hostile action from a rogue government. That night, Weaver and his wife Vicky wrote a letter to the Aryan Nations. They said that they were armed and ready to stand against the government. A few months later, in December, Randy and Vicky were riding up a country road to the cabin when they pulled over to help a pair of stranded motorists standing next to a broken-down pickup truck.
It was a cold and snowy day. They were stopped on a bridge. When I walked up to try to help, several agents jumped me and threw me to the ground. A female agent posing to be the stranded wife threw Vicky to the ground with her face in the snow.
Randy and Vicky Weaver were white separatists, people who believe in the separation of races. But they weren't radicals who posed a legitimate threat to anyone. They wanted to be left alone. Again and again in the story of the rise of the far right, the federal government, through its overreach, would make enemies of people who weren't enemies to begin with. After a night in jail and an arraignment, the Weavers were released on bail. Randy would have to return for trial in February. But as the trial approached, the U.S. Attorney for Idaho got a threatening letter addressed to, quote, the servant of Queen of Babylon, signed by Vicki Weaver. It promised, whether we live or whether we die, we will not bow to your evil commandments. Randy never showed up for trial, and a failure to appear warrant was issued. The case was now referred to the U.S. Marshals, the federal law enforcement arm that deals with fugitives. Local newspapers started to run stories about the heavily armed neo-Nazi who had skirted the government and was holed up in his cabin with his family.
I was a reporter for the Spokesman Review in Spokane, Washington. An aggressive young reporter doing anything to get on the story.
This is Jess Walter, a writer you may know for his best-selling novels like Beautiful Ruins. But back when the Weaver standoff was starting, he was a hungry young journalist hoping to dig into Randy Weaver's past.
I had the idea of tracking down Randy Weaver's family in Iowa and kind of figuring out how, you know, this Army veteran ended up on a mountaintop with an army of federal agents trying to arrest him. He grew up in Iowa, you know, saw himself as a kind of all-American kid, volunteered for the Army in 1968 at the height of the Vietnam War, received special forces training, although he was never in combat. When he got out, he married a woman named Vicki and settled down in a job at the John Deere tractor factory. I think he would have had the life you imagine of this kind of small town Iowa figure, if not for the Weavers finding their way into these apocalyptic beliefs.
The Weavers adopted the same apocalyptic form of Christianity as groups like the CSA. They believed that there would one day be a showdown between white Christians and the corrupt world around them. Riots would consume the cities.
They found their way into this kind of conspiratorial thinking, sort of the grandparents of the QAnon conspiracies that we all know about now.
They believed in the Zionist-occupied government, that Jews controlled everything, and that agents of that government, the forces of Babylon, would come to take them away. They started amassing guns and ammunition and learned survival skills. But as long as they lived near cities, they felt that they would never be safe. Here's Randy Weaver again.
We had had beliefs that if there ever was a natural disaster or downfall of the government or whatever, we wanted to be separated from the rest of the world. We did not want to be a part of it.
That led the Weavers down this long path of wanting to move to a mountaintop where they could be safe and protect their family. That led them to Idaho, where the Weavers chose to live was this knob, you know, one hill in the foothills of the western Rocky Mountains, in that part of the state that points like a gun barrel to the Canadian border. It was a pretty isolated place. Wooded land covered in pine and fir trees that had everything they were looking for, a kind of 360-degree lookout to keep them from being invaded and attacked by the federal agents that by then they believed would come after them. It very much was the kind of place the Weavers were looking to wait out the end of the world.
The site they chose had promise buried in its name. It was known as Ruby Ridge. Ruby Ridge wasn't far from the Hayden Lake compound of the Church of the Aryan Nations. The white separatist Weavers had similar views, and it wasn't long before Randy Weaver attended one of the world congresses. He only went to the compound a couple of times before he was approached about modifying shotguns and got into trouble with the federal government. By March of 1992, Weaver was still refusing to turn himself in. I've spent the last two decades researching and covering federal law enforcement, and if there's one thing I've learned about the way that the government operates, it's this. It doesn't forget. Randy Weaver didn't really matter to the government at all. He was a white supremacist adjacent hustler. This nobody, who on balance had very little to do with the government's mission to rout domestic terror, was becoming an embarrassment. His routine failure to appear warrant had risen to high-level meetings in Washington, D.C. The director of the U.S. Marshals and other executives plotted on how to resolve it. Weaver wanted to resolve it too, but he was afraid of losing his family, his home. Isolated on this mountaintop, he was getting more and more desperate and more paranoid.
We had been deceived and lied to so many times. We were looking for a miracle. I was looking for Jesus Christ to walk in and solve the situation because at that time he's the only one I would have believed in.
In Idaho, the local marshals were making plans on how to get Randy down from the mountain.
It's his territory. It's like an animal in the woods. You know, they have their territory and they know their country. And in our case, we don't know that country that well. But we've dealt with this stuff before, and we'll do it again if we have to.
And that brings us back to the moment from the beginning of the episode. It's Friday, August 21st, 1992. That team of six heavily armed deputy U.S. Marshals are in the woods outside of Randy Weaver's compound with a camcorder.
Well, this is the approach from August.
They had their whole special operations group in the forest preparing for how they were going to eventually arrest him when everything went wrong. The Weaver's dog alerts.
Randy Weaver, his 14-year-old son Sammy, and a family friend named Kevin Harris all grab guns and run out into the woods, following the sound of the barks. When the dog reaches the marshals in the woods, one of them opens fire, killing the dog instantly. Young Sammy arrives seconds later.
Sam Weaver said, "You shot my dog, you son of a bitch," and opened fire on them. They fired back.
The marshals shoot Sammy in the back, killing him. Kevin Harris opens fire.
William Deegan, a decorated U.S. Marshal, was shot by Kevin Harris as they were firing back and forth. And then the Marshal Service hunkered down with Deegan as the Weavers turned and ran back to their cabin.
U.S. Marshal William Deegan died in the firefight. And in response, the government did what it often did in situations of escalated violence. It miscommunicated and then overreacted.
The Marshal Service calls this in and says that there's an active firefight with armed white supremacists in the Idaho forest. This message goes to the FBI. The FBI scrambles from Quantico, its hostage rescue team, its elite SWAT team, telling its agents that they're flying into an active firefight.
The FBI had been given bad information. They believed that the marshals were still pinned down by gunfire from the Weavers, and that Randy Weaver himself was firing on them from the cabin with fully automatic weapons.
That night, the FBI arrives. The hostage rescue team sets up in a perimeter around the cabin.
Covered in camo and heavily armed, it looks like a war zone in this small Idaho community. Dozens of FBI agents remain entrenched in the brush of this mountain. Randy Weaver, his wife, four children, and a friend remain armed and barricaded in their mountain compound with no intention yet of giving up.
The FBI had no idea that Sammy Weaver had been killed in the firefight or that Randy Weaver and his family didn't pose much of a threat. They thought that they were facing off with a dangerous white supremacist group like the Order or CSA. They issued special rules of engagement to the sharpshooter team.
The usual rules of engagement for any law enforcement are that you can't fire at someone and use deadly force unless they're threatening you. According to the FBI agents that day, if they were flying into a live firefight with white supremacists, then they were by nature in danger. The rules that they said were that deadly force can and should be used against any armed adult. People didn't have to pose a threat, they just had to have a gun. Well, the Weavers always had guns.
The next day, snipers are watching the Weaver cabin. Inside, the family is distraught and nervous.
They're hiding in the cabin, sure that more federal agents are going to attack them. They had brought Samuel Weaver's body back to a shed that they had near their house. And Randy and Kevin Harris and Randy's 16-year-old daughter, Sarah, decided to go check on the body.
Randy and Kevin grab rifles and step out of the cabin door to go to the shed.
All of a sudden, a gunshot rings out. One of the FBI agents shoots at Randy Weaver and hits him in the armpit. But Randy's incredibly lucky that he wasn't killed. Vicki Weaver, his wife, comes out on the porch holding the door open, screaming, "Get back in the house, get back in the house."
Randy, Sarah, and Kevin run for the cabin. As they reach the cabin door, the FBI sniper takes another shot, which misses Randy and goes through the door as the three dive inside.
I drove up from my newsroom to Naples, Idaho, and joined the other reporters at the standoff. There was a meadow near the cabin. There were helicopters, Humvees, armored personnel carriers, 100, you know, tents, and, you know, it really did look like an army base.
These are Americans. These are God-fearing people.
By this time, a kind of large-scale protest had begun at the roadblock.
I'm here for Randy Weaver, and this is what I want. I want the truth.
Other people with beliefs similar to the Weavers, other members of the Aryan Nations and other groups, skinheads from various places came to try to join the Weavers in their fight.
So I'll tell you what, I'll go up there right now if they'll drop me in by helicopter and die with them, because it ain't right.
It was part just strange to see these people come out of the woodwork with these, you know, incredibly strange beliefs. But I also remember there was a guy who ran a tire shop in Spokane who came with a sign. It really was, for me, the first realization that this stuff could be mainstreamed, that some of these beliefs could seep into what I thought of as more reasonable and rational corners of the American world.
On the evening of the third day of the siege, the FBI sent an armored personnel carrier up onto Ruby Ridge to destroy outbuildings and clear lines of fire for their snipers. As they were preparing to knock over a shed, they discovered the body of Sammy Weaver inside.
That, of course, gets out to the people at the roadblock.
How many fucking men did you take to kill a 14-year-old boy? You want to kill me? Do it! Kill me! What are you doing?
How many dead patriots will you bury? How many will you put dirt in their faces and watch them and their families cry?
You know, more than 100 protesters with signs saying baby killers and all these things. It was this incredibly tense situation. There was a group of skinheads that was arrested on a back road with rifles trying to get to the Weavers. And so there was very much a fear that other groups would use this as a way to battle against the government themselves.
With tensions rising, the FBI wasn't getting anywhere in their negotiations with Randy Weaver. In fact, they still hadn't even made contact. And that's when a man named Bo Greitz arrived on the scene. Greitz had been Weaver's commander during Vietnam.
Greitz says he'll do everything he can to defuse the situation and prevent any more bloodshed.
I remember him as a young, enthusiastic soldier that was trying to apply his skills at a time when this country was at war. I told Randy that if he did remember me, that he'll know that I'm someone who he can trust.
On day 9 of the standoff, Greitz was allowed to go up to the cabin. He shouted through a megaphone to communicate with Weaver. And that's when he learned something no one else at the time knew. Randy's wife, Vicki, was dead. Days earlier, when that FBI sniper had fired on the Weavers as they ran back to the cabin, he'd missed, and the bullet had gone through the cabin door. What no one knew was that Vicki Weaver was on the other side of the door, holding their 10-month-old baby, and that the bullet hit her in the jaw, killing her instantly. Greitz learned Randy Weaver was wounded too. Kevin Harris was seriously wounded. Weaver's daughter Sarah and the baby were okay, but they'd all spent more than a week in the small cabin with Vicky's body.
I still remember clearly Bogreitz came down with the news that Vicki Weaver had been killed.
I've got good news and I've got bad news.
And by this time, there were 150, maybe 200 people at the roadblock. You could see government snipers in the trees on the other side of the roadblock. It really felt like this could become violent at any moment.
The bad news, and get a grip on yourself, is that Vicki was killed. Most unfortunate thing.
I remember people having to be held back as they tried to rush at the agents on the other side of the roadblock.
Never will you take another woman down.
I remember someone screaming, "This means war.
We're going to war. They don't care if you die. They put you out here in front. You're nothing.
We are so hurt for this injustice done to us by our own government."
And that night, I think all of us thought that this was going to explode into something far worse.
Tensions were high. The skinheads at the roadblock seemed to be girding for an assault. The standoff was costing the U.S. government $1 million a day. But over the next 48 hours, through Greitz's negotiations, Vicki's body was taken out of the cabin, and the wounded Kevin Harris was taken to a hospital. Greitz continued negotiations with Randy Weaver, who on the 10th day finally agreed to surrender and walked out of the cabin with his kids.
He just cried his wife's name, he cried his son's name, and then he stood up tall like a man, and we marched on down the road like we said we were going to do.
Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris were arrested and arraigned on a variety of charges, including first-degree murder for the death of the U.S. Marshal. The scene at the roadblock died down as protesters returned home and the FBI packed up their equipment.
When it all ended, it was so strange. We went to the Deep Creek Inn. I knew at that moment that I was going to interview Sarah Weaver the next day and that I needed to stay sober, and so I volunteered to bartend. It was a Swiss man named Lorenz who had just bought the Deep Creek Inn. And if you can imagine being from Switzerland and you buy this bar out in the middle of the woods and all of a sudden you have tanks rolling by and skinheads, you know, coming in to buy drinks. He had no idea what had happened. And he said, "I hope someone will tell me what this all meant." And I looked out and there were federal agents having drinks, you know, in their camo with skinheads, with reporters, with constitutionalists. I remember an agent jokingly buying a round of Heinekens for the Nazis, you know, and all of a sudden, it was like one country again over drinks. And I remember seeing it through Lorenz's eyes and just feeling like, you know, we've lost our minds here. I always saw Lorenz as this just deeply confused and sort of heartbroken person. And this wasn't the America he thought he was coming to. He ended up having real mental problems that his family believed were because of this, and he ended up stepping in front of a truck. When he died, it was a kind of coda to this tragedy that was so unnecessary and that, you know, I think exposed this deep vein of something rotten at the heart of the country.
Ultimately, the trials of Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris would only add further pain to the government. A jury found Weaver not guilty of all charges except for the initial failure to appear. Kevin Harris was found not guilty on all charges. The Weaver family sued the U.S. government over the death of Vicki Weaver and won a $3 million settlement. The Senate's own investigative report concluded, "The shooting of Vicki Weaver as she held her baby daughter will haunt federal law enforcement for years to come." And indeed, that was a sentiment that proved true. Because the most lasting legacy of Ruby Ridge, its long shadow, came with its impact on the far right in America.
It really did reverberate through all of these corners of conspiratorial thinking, of radical right-wing thought. And it mainstreamed some of those thoughts. It seemed to prove to those people who believe that government is a force of evil, it seemed to prove that, look, they can just go after a family this way. The way that this case had been handled had made their prophecy seem to come true.
Just a few months after Ruby Ridge, a white power summit was held in Estes Park, Colorado. Groups from all over the country came together, energized and newly radicalized in their fight against the government. As anger over what the government did at Ruby Ridge grew across the country, the ranks of white power groups swelled. And then, less than a year later, the government presided over the burning of the Branch Davidian compound at Waco.
We've had 35 to 40 mile an hour winds, and this fire is racing out of control.
And the deaths of 76 Branch Davidians. Everywhere there were signs and symbols of the government's tyranny, and rage in the far right ranks was growing. By 1995, it would result in the single worst act of homegrown terrorism ever perpetrated on U.S. soil, the Oklahoma City bombing.
At the center of it all, of course, is the bombed-out shell of the federal office building.
That's on the next episode of Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right. If you want to know more about the rise of white supremacy in the 1980s, please read Kathleen Belew's excellent book, Bring the War Home: The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. And for the full, wild story of Ruby Ridge, pick up Jess Walter's Ruby Ridge: The Truth and Tragedy of the Randy Weaver Family. Jess, of course, is also an amazing fiction writer, so check out his novels, too. Long Shadow, Rise of the American Far Right is a co-production of Longlead and Campside Media. The show is produced by Ryan Swikert. Callie Hitchcock is our associate producer. Executive producers are John Patrick Pullen and Josh Dean, who also served as Long Shadow story editors. Audience development by Heather Muse. Will DeGravio is our research assistant. Fact-checking by Rebecca Holland. Mark McAdam did the mix. Sound design by Ryan Swikert. Cover art by Longlead's creative director, Sarah Rogers. A special thanks to Jennifer Bassett, who consulted on the podcast. Music by Blue Dot Sessions and APM. Learn more about Longlead and subscribe to our newsletter at longlead.com. And if you're enjoying the show, spread the word and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find the show. I'm Garrett Graff, and thanks for listening.